Hello from Midori House in London and a very warm welcome to Sunday Brunch. We're live here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up on today's programme, a celebration of the cultural contribution made by refugees from Nazi Germany to modern British life. We also meet a former BBC journalist who's sharing his private passion with a new exhibition of all the artwork he's collected. And how do you rewrite Shakespeare?
Shall I compare you to a summer's day? You're more delightful. Always shining strong. High winds blow hard on flowering buds in May, and summer never seems to last that long.
James Anthony on the art of rewriting the Bard. Plus we meet the chef James Knappert. And Vincent McGivinny from Euronews will go through the weekend papers to make sense of all the Brexit chaos. That's all to come this hour, live from London with me, Emma Nelson, on Monocle 24. To begin today's programme, it seems all the more poignant that at a time when the United Kingdom is severing ties with the EU, that an arts festival is being held to celebrate the contributions made by those who fled from Europe to open borders and open arms here in the UK. More than 100 events will make up a festival called Insiders Outsiders here in the UK, focusing on the creative lives of the people who fled Nazi Europe. Well, Monica Bohm-Duchin is the festival director, and I'm delighted to say she joins me in the studio now. Welcome, Monica. Welcome back, Monica. You've been here before on Monocle 24 to talk about the work that you do in terms of bringing refugee art to the public eye. So just tell us a little bit, how did this festival come about?
Right, well, thank you for inviting me, first of all. The germ of the idea bubbled to the surface of my mind, shall we say, about almost exactly, in fact, two years ago, when I was interested in the possibility of an exhibition looking at Hampstead, where I've been lucky enough to be born and grown up, which, as I've known for many years, was an extraordinarily rich creative hub for those who sought refuge here and were indeed welcomed by an important, small but significant number of like-minded individuals in that lovely part of London. And as I was discussing the possibility of that exhibition, I suddenly realised that it had the potential to become something much, much, much bigger. And so it did. And I have to say, it has exceeded my wildest expectations.
What a glorious position to find yourself in. So, it starts off small, and then what's it now grown into?
Right, it's still growing, which is quite extraordinary. Even though it's officially launching, in fact, now sort of early March, which is where we are, of course, right now. It was me putting out feelers to people I knew already to be interested in the field, and one person, one idea leads to another. I put people in touch with each other, the word then gets round, people come to me, or to my team, I should say. I'm not working on this entirely by myself, of course. So it grew from there, and the moment there's a piece of publicity, again, more people come to us, and it's both institutions who may have been either planning something relevant or had the idea for something relevant, but weren't quite sure when and how to do it. Equally, the children or sometimes grandchildren of distinguished refugees from that generation who, quite understandably, are keen for their parents, their grandparents' achievements to be out there in the open.
So what is in this festival exactly?
Right. It's very much across all the art forms. We decided that the arts would be possibly the best way to communicate vividly and easily to a non-specialist audience. It's entertaining, it's not over-didactic, it's a way of, sort of opening people's eyes across the spectrum, of British public. That sounds pompous. So it's the arts in the broadest sense. So it straddles, obviously the visual arts, but it's architecture, design, fine art. It is dance, film, theatre, literature. I've left something out, I'm sure, but you get the idea. So across all the art forms and across all the country, the whole country, I've been very pleased that it's certainly not just London. I never wanted it to be, and it's been a kind of really quite natural process.
Tell us a little bit about the people whose artworks are featured in this large festival. I mean, we'll come to some big hitters in a minute, but these are all individuals who have personal stories of flight to tell and have landed in the United Kingdom.
Absolutely. I mean, just one general point before I talk about specific individuals. I think it's very important to make people aware that for all that we're celebrating the undoubted achievements and indeed the legacy of some very truly remarkable individuals, that achievement, that success, is against a backdrop of profound uprooting, dislocation, trauma, loss. I mean, nearly every individual mentioned in, or who features in the festival, indeed mentioned in the companion volume being published by Lund Humphreys this very week, experienced a loss. They lost close family members in the Holocaust. So, that dark backdrop must never be forgotten. And I suppose, paradoxically, that sense of profound loss was a spur in many cases, to creativity. As regards individuals, it's hard to know really where to start because each story is totally unique, often quite blood-curdling and certainly, you know, sort of disturbing and upsetting very often. But all the stories have certain things in common, and I suppose I've touched on what those common factors might be. Starting perhaps with the artist who, you were asking me about just a few minutes ago before we came on air, Joseph Herman, whose wonderful image called Refugees from 1941 graces the cover of the London Humphreys book I've just mentioned, but also has become a kind of like a signature motif for the project as a whole. We're using it for publicity generally. It features prominently on the website and so on and so forth. Joseph Herman was born in 1911, I think it was, as the son of a literate cobbler, a Yiddish-speaking illiterate cobbler, in that respect different to most of the refugees who came from Central Europe in the 30s, because they were mostly middle class, more assimilated, more acculturated, westernized, etc. But he's perhaps an exception that proves the rule. But his story has many things in common with others. He decides in 1938 to leave an increasingly anti-Semitic Poland. Let's not forget that Poland, you know, was not exactly blameless in all this. And he comes originally to Brussels, then, of course, that part of the world, the Low Countries, get invaded by the Nazis, and he eventually finds sanctuary in Glasgow, of all places, in Scotland. And it's in Scotland in 1940 where he realises full well what fate is likely, almost certainly going to overtake his family back in Poland, that he produces this extraordinary body of works, quite Chagall-like in certain ways, but the one, Refugees, the one we're using, is part of that series. It's a kind of cry of anguish, really, about the need to flee. And I think, you know, the reason we chose it is that it does actually have a universal relevance. It's not only historically specific.
It's interesting that you say that every piece of art that this is created in your exhibition and in your festivals is born out of the experience of someone who has experienced dislocation, trauma, and loss. How much does that experience define what art then follows? Is there a thread that you can spot in absolutely everything that you are curating here?
No, I think it would be rash to overgeneralise, and I noticed that you used the term refugee art, which I would be slightly reluctant to use because it seems to suggest something homogeneous and monolithic, which of course is not what we're talking about. In fact, the output is extremely diverse and of course in different art forms necessarily so. Having said that, there is a strand you can trace, which I suppose you would call essentially Northern European expressionism, you know, this sort of very painterly, heavily sort of worked surfaces, if one's talking about painting. Strong colours, distorted form, and the Joseph Herman refugees image is very much a case in point, which is a very un-English way of making images, and it was seen as alien by many Brits at the time, I have to say. In some cases, that way of making images continues throughout the artist's career, but equally, in other cases, and indeed Joseph Herman is once more a case in point, what happens later in 1943, I think it was, he decides to go to a small Welsh mining village in the Swansea Valley, and there he changes style quite dramatically, but he finds a kind of surrogate community there, and he starts painting these rather stately, monumentalising, dignified images of miners at work and at rest. So in other words, that expressionist phase in some cases is a relatively short-lived phase. Although having said that, it's interesting to see how that strand gets taken up or kind of perpetuated by people like Frank Auerbach, of course, or Lucian Freud, you know, still today, or more than ever today, considered the grand old men of, you know, British, not so British, British art. But that expressionist tendency that we tend to associate with Central and Eastern Europe has, you know, was quite unacceptable in this country in the 30s, but has gradually, I think, through the likes of Auerbach and Freud, become part of what British culture is also about.
There's an excellent section in your book which taps into the fact that this isn't just visual art that we're talking about.
No.
We have people who are deeply involved in design and architecture. I mean, of course, the name Walter Gropius comes up. Tell us a little bit more about the sort of that contribution that's made.
Absolutely. Starting with Gropius, yes, and not just Gropius, Laszlo Moholy-Nagy and Marcel Breuer, the three, you know, big names associated with the German art and design school, the Bauhaus, and this year, just serendipitously, is the centenary of its founding, so there are many events to do with the Bauhaus under the umbrella of the festival. Gropius wasn't Jewish. He was, and I hesitate slightly, but this is also a story that needs to be told. There were certain figures, Gropius is one, Rudolf Laban, the pioneering dance choreographer, is another, who could have stayed and indeed were willing to accommodate to the Nazi regime. And who's to judge? Who's to judge them? When push came to shove, though, their modernist way of making, whether it was dance or indeed architecture, made them fall from grace. You know, they couldn't possibly work under the Third Reich. And so they left. And what's very little known is that these, going back to the Bauhaus, that these major figures, and also some lesser known figures, a few of whom actually stayed in this country, but the likes of Gropius, if you look at most of the writing on him, it doesn't mention the fact that they came to this country at all. The trajectory is, yes, they had to leave Germany, they go to the States. But they come for a brief while in the mid to late 30s, and who they consort with, the influence they wield, very, very fascinating indeed, and it's an overlooked area.
One thing that seems to be overriding at the moment, let's fast forward to the modern day, and we've got the United Kingdom severing ties and some arguing building walls. The way that immigrants, refugees are considered at the moment in many ways is what contribution they can make economically to the United Kingdom. Should we allow skilled workers, unskilled workers, this, that and the other? What is it that your exhibition says that suggests that perhaps someone who comes from another country for whatever reason is much more interesting than what jobs they can do and what contribution they can make to the British coffers?
Yes, I could. I mean, I know. We're on the same wavelength here quite clearly. I don't want to be heavy-handed about this, but clearly a crucial subtext, if you like, of what we're doing is to plant the idea in people's minds a little bit more firmly that those who come, as you say, for whatever reason, but let's concentrate on refugees for the moment, who knows what they're going to contribute? I mean, especially those who come as children, and we mentioned Auerbach and Freud, for example. So there is an important plea, if you like, that underpins everything that this festival stands for, to say, come on, let us choose internationalism, tolerance, openness over xenophobia, provincialism, racism, anti-Semitism,
etc. Did you come up against any resistance when you were coming, when you were putting together this festival? I mean, the names you've got involved are pretty huge. You've got the great galleries of the of London coming forward. But did anyone say, oh, your timing's a little bit strange?
No, on the contrary. Absolutely the contrary. In fact, it became almost predictable that when I first started talking about the project at the very beginning, people would sort of exclaim, oh, how timely. So it's the very opposite to what you're suggesting. And, you know, who could have thought, who would have dreamt that it seems so opposite now for the reasons that you've already touched on.
So you have a whole year of this. If you are in the United Kingdom for the next 12 months, where should you go? What should you see? What would you recommend?
It's very hard to single out certain events over any others.
Choose your favourite.
Choose my favourite.
We all have to choose our favourite kids. Which one's yours?
Goodness. Okay. Right. You put me on the spot.
I'll give you two.
Okay. All right. Let's start with Tate Britain. As you say, the big guns, you know, they've come on board, much to my delight. Tate in the second half of this year are doing a display in their archive gallery about a wonderful woman artist who I suspect nobody's ever heard of. She was of Austrian Jewish, partly Jewish origin, called Marie-Louise von Motosicki. She mixed when she was here with some very interesting people like Elias Canetti, bringing literature into the field. She was a good friend of Milan Kosman, who's a wonderful artist who has a show on at the moment at Clare Hall in Cambridge as we speak. And Marie-Louise Motosicki is a wonderful painter of an essentially expressionist persuasion, and that's one to look out for. And that also allows me to say that one of the excellent aspects of this whole project is that many women who have not had the attention that they deserve have been, you know, have had a chance to come into the limelight.
Monica Boom-Duchin, thank you very much indeed for joining me in the studio. And her festival, Insiders, Outsiders, well, not just hers, but a huge project, I should say, runs in the United Kingdom until March next year. Go to their website and have a look. Still to come on Monocle 24, how to rewrite Shakespeare, and we look at the weekend papers. Stay with us.
This issue, our editors and photographers were dispatched to all corners of France to paint a nuanced picture of the nation with panache in everything from aviation to architecture and from business to bread. We find out why Navy still suits the French in Toulon, the first port of call to see the nation's fleet mustering for a world-leading military role. We look into why the French turn on their leaders, from Macron back to the storming of the Bastille, and see how one factory nailed it and pinned down the market for specialist hardware. We also ask why the Americans are eyeing up Lyon for the future of TV, and meet the Franco-Syrian refugee who launched a global construction firm. And we see why Mont Blanc is still summit special in our photo-led expo report. Plus, plenty more on what makes the Gallic nations strut so convincingly on the world stage. Monocle's March issue is out now. Get your copy today or subscribe at monocle.com.
It's 11:16 if you're brunching in Berlin, 10:16 here in London. You're listening to Sunday Brunch with Emma Nelson. Now, so much of the world's great art is kept from view. Once bought, it sits on the walls of its owner, or even worse, in a bank vault to be enjoyed by nobody. Well, thankfully, my next guest on Sunday Brunch is rather more generous with his collection. Tim Sayer has been collecting art for more than five decades, and when I mean collecting, I really do mean collecting. Tim's teamed up with the curator Lizzie Collins to create a show called Abstract Allies here in London. And I'm delighted to say that he's taken time out from his collecting to come and tell us all about it. Welcome to the studio, Tim.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about, for decades and decades and decades, you wrote the news for the BBC, for Radio 4. I love the way you'd raise your eyebrows when you said that. But in between telling the world about what was happening, you were gradually and quietly amassing a quite spectacular collection of art, weren't you?
I was.
Tell us a little bit about it.
It was always said it was on a very modest BBC salary, because, as you know, they are pretty small unless you're a great star. When I was 17, I bought some old prints in a junk shop in Richmond in Surrey. That sort of started me, gave me the slight bug. Of course, I was still at school then. I was 17, did I say? Yes. And a few years later, I bought my first print, real print, was from the Royal Academy Summer Exhibition. Then I bought a John Nash from the Summer Exhibition years after that. Then the collection grew in all sorts of areas. I had friends, I made friends with artists, I made friends with gallerists, and I had friends who encouraged me to collect. So it did, just like Topsy, it just grew and grew and grew and went in various directions. I went through a sort of modern British phase, which was very figurative, then a narrative phase. But recently, hence this show that I'm doing, I've concentrated more on abstract art.
Well, tell us a little bit more about this show, because for those of us who've ever had the chance to go to your house, which I count myself as very lucky to do that, you can't move for art from all genres, and your cat is extremely deft at picking her way.
Him. Poor Otty.
Picking his way through, sort of going past the Hockneys on the way to the loo. Just tell us a little bit about why you decided to focus on abstract art and what it was about it that lit your fire and when.
Strange, isn't it? You would. It's very difficult explaining abstract art to people. I think you have to look at it a lot, and it's very much almost a visceral reaction to it. I find art that's trying to tell a story very dull. I would much prefer to look at an abstract painting and interpret it myself, and talk to the artist about, to a certain extent, about why they have done what they have.
Is it necessary? And it's one thing that I think when you do look at abstract art, or when I do, I sometimes wish I had the artist next to me to just go, so what's happening here? Although on other occasions I'm quite glad that they left me to it. I mean, how does that change the way you see something?
It depends on the artist, really. Some of them aren't very good. Some of them don't want to talk about the work anyway, and they just say, look, I've done this, it's up to you to interpret it. So I do that. Others explain technical matters, things like that, which is interesting, of course. But on the whole, they tend to let you get on with it and say, well, if you don't get it, that's your loss.
Go and look at something else and get the joy from something
else.
Well,
yes, exactly.
So tell us a little bit more about what's happening at the Zulika Gallery. Abstract Allies, it's an exhibition of abstract art, and you've teamed up with the curator Lizzie Collins. Tell us about the process.
The process. Lizzie had an exhibition of an abstract artist called, what is his name? It'll come back to me in a minute, Nigel Hall, a year or so ago. And I caught it on the last day, staggered up the three flights of stairs to the gallery, fell through the door. And it was a beautiful show, of course. And I knew Lizzie already. And we got talking about abstract art. And I think I went to the gallery again. And I jokingly said, well, we should do it. We share so many interests. Why don't we do a show together? Jokingly. And she grabbed me almost and nearly tied me down until So that's how it started.
You got more than you planned for.
I certainly did, and it's taken up a lot of time recently. And what we've done, we've taken some of Lizzie's artists and some of my artists and a few artists like Nigel and a few others who are mutual friends. And I'm pleased to say we've got an age range of 27 to 91. Can you believe?
Yes.
And we've got 8 living women artists and 4 who are not. And so it's a good and a lot of men. So it's not so many men, I could tell you. Only 10 men, 12 women. But it's a vast range, and I think we have not disagreed on choosing any of the artists.
Well, tell us about how you go through the selection process. I asked my last guest, Monica, about how she, you know, if she could choose her favourite exhibition from her latest show, Insiders Outsiders, and she said it's impossible to choose. I'm going to ask you the same question. How did you go about selecting, given the fact that you have got so much art to choose from? How did you go around picking your favourites or coming up with any themes or ideas?
It's not a difficult one. It fell into place almost because I thought to myself, well, I've got living artists who I'd like to give a show to. Some have never been heard of before and need to be heard of. Others are well known. Let's see what we can mix. Let's try to keep most of them living. I was very grateful or glad to get some pieces by a man called Naum Garbo, who is a Russian constructivist. That sort of set the tone, as he was doing these pieces in the 30s. So we sort of started there and moved on to the 50s, 60s, 70s, and we're still at it. We've, as I said, we've got Amelia Kate Sampson, who is 27. She lives in a bus with her boyfriend in a field in Dorset.
Who doesn't dream of living with my boyfriend in a bus? Yes. I think we all live. Yes. I think we all do that in our dreams.
Well,
don't we?
I think we do. And apparently, they've got a wooden stove or something, and it's jolly cozy. But so that, yeah, that was we. It is amazing how it all fell into place. Lizzie suggested an artist, and I said, "Yeah, I know that work, or I don't know that work. Let's look at it." And as I said, everything fell very much.
And if you had no clue about abstract art, because a lot of people don't, I mean, you see people staggering around Frieze once a year with that look of bemusement.
Amusement or bemusement?
Many reactions on the face. I must confess, I then go and take refuge in Frieze Masters afterwards, just as sort of a massive palate cleanser, and to take me back to exactly what most people think art is all about. How much does this exhibition actually give people a little bit of a sort of sparking a little bit of joy in the way that abstract art and modern art will change your life?
Well, I hope we're going to get people in gently, because we've also got some ceramics which they're not linear. They're not linear abstracts. They are abstract forms, but I think people will find that a good way of coming into the art. They're not going to be immediately hit by something really stark and say, what the heck is that? Why are they showing?
Why have you decided not to shock?
I don't think it ever occurred to me to shock. This time, I know it's unlike you would say that's unlike me, but no shock this time. Educate, I think, but definitely ease people into the abstract. Okay. And hope they like it.
Tim Sayer, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24. You can see Abstract Allies at the Zuleika Gallery from the 6th to the 29th of March. And if you dip in your pockets, you can buy it as well, can't you, Tim?
You can.
Good.
And they're very cheap, some of them.
You can help him fund his trip. He can help Tim fund his bus that he's going to live in with his wife. You're listening to Sunday Brunch. It's time now for one of our regular features, Weekend Reads. James Anthony writes and rewrites poetry. He also writes fiction, travel and screenplays, and his latest book is called Shakespeare's Sonnets Retold, Classic Love Poems with a Modern Twist. He spoke to Georgina Godwin.
I started it for personal reasons, which was to understand what the great bard was talking about, because these poems are full with such lyricism and such intense emotion, but they're written in 400-year-old language, which makes it very difficult to understand. So my initial objective was just to help myself to understand what was going on within these sonnets. And I started with Sonnet 18, which is the most famous of them all. And I just started rewriting it one morning in a way that I could understand in contemporary English, but on a line-by-line basis, but retaining the poetic structure of it, which was the iambic pentameter and the rhyming of these 14-line poems. And I did Sonnet 18, and it led to another one, and ultimately 154 of them.
Well, I think that we should have perhaps just a little taste of Sonnet 18. That, of course, is the very famous one that starts, "Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's leaf hath all too short a date." So let's have the first four lines, but in James Anthony language.
Well, thank you. "Shall I compare you to a summer's day? You're more delightful, always shining strong. High winds blow hard on flowering buds in May, and summer never seems to last that long."
And let's skip to the closing couplet.
"So long as people breathe or eyes review, these words live on, reminding them of you."
And of course the original ends, "So long as men can breathe or eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee," which might have made perfect sense to an audience 400 years ago, but of course your version speaks to people today.
Indeed, and I think that's what my hope is for the book, is that people will understand the words through my versions, but revert back to what was these almost perfect poems that were written and are often overlooked. So I hope that through this book that the originals will find a new lease of life to people who are interested in learning about what he was actually saying.
As you say, these almost perfect poems, so actually taking them on is quite challenging.
Yes, I think it is. But as I said, I didn't feel it as a challenge initially when I started out, because I really didn't start this project with the intention of it becoming a published book, which removed all of the threat to me as a writer. And I think that was probably liberating. Mm. And I started it knowing that people were going to be thinking some of this was sacrilegious or some of them were going to be judging it. Then I think it might have changed the way I approached it. And I might have said, well, actually, that's probably too much of a bigger challenge for me to take on. But yeah. So I approached it without any threat or any risk in my mind. And I just worked my way through it, one a day for nearly a year.
Do you think that today's poetry readers are lazier, that people need this reinterpretation to engage?
Well, I think that poetry can be very difficult for someone who's not experienced poetry to really to understand and, more importantly, to enjoy. A lot of the poetry is very clever and almost a bit too clever for its own good. And that really wasn't my intention. What I was trying to do, and I think that Shakespeare wrote for the masses, and he tried to appeal to the masses. And I think that poetry, to be accessible, needs to do that. So it doesn't need to be difficult. So is the modern reader lazy? No, I don't think so. But I think that they will read what appeals to them. And I hope that the words that I've expressed in my reinterpretations will appeal to everybody, or at least will be able to be understood by everybody. Mm. And they won't read them and say, I'm sorry, I don't know what he's talking about. That really was what I was trying to do. I was trying to make this poetry for the layman, just like Shakespeare was in the day when he was writing his plays. He wasn't trying to be over clever, but with 400 years passing, of course, the language feels a little bit too clever sometimes. So I don't think they're lazy, and I think that people just in poems can be extremely enjoyable as a short form of release, if you like. It's a 14-line, it takes a minute to read. And it can be escapism, and that's what I'm hoping with this. And it's just a form of entertainment.
It's not, of course, the first time you've taken Shakespeare on. You've retold some of his plays, too.
I have indeed. I've written three of them at the moment, and I've got more in the offering. And that's a different challenge, because they are all written in iambic pentameter, and I rewrite them in iambic pentameter, which is the five beats per line, "Shall I compare thee to a summer's day?" But they don't rhyme. And so plays are actually easier to do, and they tend not to be as compact and as dense as the sonnets are. So the sonnets really compress massive amounts of emotions into these lines, and they are very, very intense and well thought through lines. And this was a real challenge doing the sonnets. It was much harder than doing the plays.
Mm. And with the plays, the plot stays the same?
Identical. And what I'm trying to do with it is these great plays don't need rewriting or don't need retelling. They are written at this pace, but a lot of the interpretations are done at different paces. So what I've done is I've written them line by line, and that retains the pace at which William Shakespeare intended the plays to be performed. And by taking each line and translating it in a contemporary way, we've retained the story, but unearthed, hopefully, some of the hidden meaning within some of the terminology that he chooses to use.
And what sort of receptions it had?
Well, the sonnet's starting to have a very good reception. We've had some very positive reviews. Of course, there's been a few people who aren't going to like this, which is also great to hear. But on the whole, people have really enjoyed what I've done, which is good to hear.
And you've got one very high-profile fan, in fact.
Well, yes. Well, yes, Stephen Fry has written the foreword for the book and has been very generous in his praise. In fact, Stephen wrote a book back in 2002 called The Ode Less Travelled, which is a poetry book about how to write poetry for the layman, which I am. It was a revelation to me. It really taught me the beauty of the rules, the strict rules of poetry, of iambic pentameter, of meter, of rhyme, and all of these different forms. And so I followed that book greatly. And so Stephen has helped me not only to learn how to write poetry, he's also given me a sort of a leg up in getting the book out into the public.
Oh, fantastic. Finally, James, do you write your own poetry?
My own poetry took me to this point, really. I always dreamed of being a rock star, and I couldn't sing and I couldn't play guitar very well, and I certainly couldn't write any songs. So I was left with poetry, but I enjoy poetry, always have, and I found poetry to be like have the meter of a pop song and sentiment of some of the best pop songs. And so I've enjoyed my writing poetry. I've written it for personal consumption, and really they were sort of exercises in expressing yourself. And poetry really is about getting the intense feelings you have in your heart and in your mind onto a piece of paper in a compact form. And I refined that process. And what I enjoyed most of all was writing in this almost the old-fashioned tight formats of, say, for example, a sonnet. And that really drew me to some of the older styles of poetic writing, where they were much more rigid, much more diligent in their execution of poetry to the meter, to iambic pentameter in particular. And so that really helped me with this book, and that led me to this as being my first published work. But I still love writing poetry and getting these ideas down and trying to convey them in a verse as opposed to just writing them in prose, which, you know, anyone can do, but verse is always a challenge. So yes, poetry's been a great release for me, and I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and it was just an immense privilege to be able to spend a year nearly within the mind and the heart of William Shakespeare, getting under the skin of this great man and being able to rewrite his poems in the way that I have.
And James Anthony's Shakespeare Sonnets Retold, Classic Love Poems with a Modern Twist, is out now. He was talking to Georgina Godwin, and to hear more from Georgina, check out Meet the Writers. You can find the full back catalogue online at monocle.com. You're with Monocle 24. This is Sunday Brunch with Emma Nelson, and we go through the weekend papers next.
Weighing in at almost 400 pages, the Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes is packed with everything you need to know about making a great place to live. The book is filled with handsome residences and all the contacts you need to make a home that will last a lifetime. And it's a book that celebrates the people who know homes should be able to cope with kids, dogs, and a few scuff marks too. It's a book that knows a home is only as good as the community it's in, and it's a book that takes you through the front doors of everything from mountain hideaways to modernist towers. So be cosy and buy your copy today at monocle.com.
To come, a delicious tasting menu courtesy of the chef in Park Lane here in London. But first, with the time at 10:34, let's get our teeth into something more intellectually meaty. Or I hope we could say that. I'm joined in the studio by Vincent McAvinney, the UK correspondent from Euronews NBC, who has done all the heavy lifting when it comes to this weekend's papers. Thank you, Vincent.
Good morning.
Thanks, Vinny.
No worries.
Good to see you, and thank you for reading all the stuff, because yes, I think many of us now experience the Brexit fatigue of,
yes,
Jean-Claude Juncker. Mm-hmm. A lot of sympathy, our hearts went out to that a couple of weeks ago. So thank you for having a look. Now, what astonishes me is on the front page of the Sunday Times, the first conciliatory and almost positive clue of what's going on in Brexit.
Yes.
Do we have hope?
Well, there is some hope, but it's definitely going to be... I know that everyone is bored, and believe me, of Brexit, and knows how tedious it can be at times. But the next 2 weeks are really now going to be quite critical. It is like the series finale of Brexit. And the Sunday Times leads with Brexiteers offer peace terms to May. Now, this is on the front page, but continues on page 13. But the real title here is, as they've put it, climb down, ? You can delete that question mark. This is absolutely going to be a climb down, because I think the ERG group, who are the kind of hardcore Brexiteers, about 60 or so in Theresa May's Conservative Party, were so stunned that she changed position and announced this week the possible delay that they will have. So we're going into next month where there'll be, on the 12th, a vote on Theresa May's withdrawal agreement again, although nothing in it at the moment has changed. On the 13th, a vote to rule out no deal, which will pass because if there is no appetite for no deal. And then on the 14th, an extension to Article 50 if Theresa May's deal has failed again. So it's all about, can she get this deal over the line? Now, the hardcore Brexiteers were so stunned by a Prime Minister who said for months and years, it's my deal or no deal, when she swapped that to my deal or delay, which is the mother of all U-turns, really. They are so stunned and worried because Theresa May's message now for the next 2 weeks is you either vote for my deal or you risk the whole thing, because Labour's deal died in Parliament this week. So they are now backing the second referendum, which would also require a delay to do that. So they're now worried that it's either take Theresa May's deal or the whole thing could go. And I think they're looking at polls, they're looking at the rise of the new independent group of MPs and thinking, I don't know how much longer we can carry public support because the effects are becoming real. So this climb down, they've got this panel of lawyers and they're talking about terms that they're going to put in, working with the DUP, who also support Theresa May, for them to accept a deal. But I think this is quite a bit of a panic stations from them now.
What I can't understand is this absolute hatred of a delay. The fact is that when you get divorced, you don't rush to get divorced as quickly as you can. You work to get the best deal that you possibly can. And if that ends up dragging it out even further, then so be it. I mean, people say, yes, of course, that suggests that the cards are handed to the European Union because they can spot weakness in the British position. But surely the ERG, okay, I suppose they are wishing catastrophe and chaos in the United Kingdom, but surely anybody else with the slightest brain would suggest, let's get this right.
I mean, indeed, and I think that's what the country is starting to think, and I think the polls show that. And what's good in the Sunday Times is they've done a breakdown of this group. So you've got people, people like Boris Johnson, Jacob Rees-Mogg, Boris Johnson, everything Boris Johnson does calculated as to what Boris Johnson can do to get into Downing Street. And so he is starting to soften in his language, Jacob Rees-Mogg starting to soften in his language. You have people, though, like Dominic Raab, the former Brexit Secretary, who did not read the Good Friday Agreement. Like, that can't be overstated enough. Like, the crucial peace agreement for the United Kingdom in Northern Ireland. He was Brexit Secretary, and all of the issues of the backstop and big concerns, the whole thing is being held up by Northern Ireland. And he didn't read it, and he still doesn't really understand that the only way to preserve the Good Friday Agreement is the backstop agreement. And so he is dragging his feet on that, but might be brought along. But then, as they point out here, you've got 20 Tory MPs who are the hardliners. So when they did a vote this week in Parliament, Yvette Cooper laid down the amendment, basically rubbing it in Theresa May's face, saying, that promise that you said yesterday about these three votes, well, I'm going to make you vote for it. So there was a vote on Wednesday night. It was meant to go through orally. Some MPs rejected, so they had to do a vote. 502 MPs, including the government, had to vote this thing through to say, yes, we agree this timetable. But 20 MPs voted against, the likes of Esther McVeigh and Andrea Jenkin, John Redwood. Now, these are the people who simply want no deal. They are hardcore ideologues on this. They want to go to WTO rules. And the fact is, the margins of this are so tight. And don't forget, Theresa May had that historic defeat, first time in history that more than 400 MPs defeated a sitting government when they're in power, because she's in this supply and confidence deal and she lost that majority at the last election, that it literally comes down to individual MPs, and it could be in the single digits that this is passed. And so with 20 still seeming to be so resistant, it does mean that I think we're going to not get a deal through again, and we'll have to have this delay, because she's even lost MPs from the last time this vote went through to the withdrawal agreement. Labour now are having a different position, and it's going to literally be down to a handful of MPs as to whether or not this gets over the line.
What's the view? I mean, you work to an international audience, a European audience. What is the view from the EU? And there's a small line here in the Sunday Times, and an excellent amount of coverage about the political toing and froing internally in the UK. But the line from Brussels is that the chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, says a pointless Brexit delay is not going to happen because the EU just wants to get on with the rest of its life, thank you very much. There's going to be no block to a Brexit deadline if there's a good enough... They won't say no to an extension of the departure if there's a good enough reason. But are people running out of patience with the UK now?
I think there is definitely a sign. And, you know, we heard that from Donald Tusk. Language, he's a very moderate speaker. But a couple of weeks ago when he said that language of, you know, there is a special place in hell for people who lied about what Brexit could be like. That was seen here as incendiary. But compared to some of the language that the UK, from some politicians here, have put towards the European Union, you know, it is a kind of, you know, it's a bit small fry, but it shows that even an organisation that is kind of quite bureaucratic and dull like the EU is now getting bored of this tedium, and they don't want it to dominate further EU council meetings, and they want it to get done. But we know throughout this entire process that they have said, if you want to stop this and walk away from it at any point you can, and you can pause Article 50 or extend Article 50, and we, you know, you don't have to crash out with no deal. Because the fact is, Article 50 was designed and thought, you know, it is a little bit opaque because they thought no one was ever going to use it. So it is the first time, and probably given the experience over the past 2 years, the only time that they're ever really going to use it. And I wouldn't be surprised if they actually pass some reforms to it after this whole process.
There's signs about a warming of relations in certain areas towards the British. The EU will take this as a learning lesson, as a huge learning lesson in how to deal with what's clearly going to be a rogue state when the UK leaves. But there's a mention of an individual called Martin Selmayr, who's the EU's top civil servant, but he has now waded in and is now actually helping this happen, and is actually offering olive leaves to the United Kingdom, despite what has been described as being a monster because of his anti-Brexit stance. And everybody is having to make a compromise.
They are, and you have to think, like, is this part of Theresa May's strategy? She knew the EU always does last-minute deals. Was she always anticipating, no matter what's happening publicly, that it would go down to the wire like this, that she might just be able to get it over the line, but there would be some concessions at the end? Do they bore everyone with it and also raise all the panic alarms to get them over? Another slight, just before we move on, interesting Brexit story. If anyone saw what I thought was pretty dreadful Brexit drama that Benedict Cumberbatch was in, The Uncivil War, on Channel 4 recently, it was on HBO in America.
I didn't see it because I couldn't bring myself to watch it.
Yeah.
Is it terrible because it's awfully done, or is it terrible because it's just unbearable?
I think that there probably is a great drama in Brexit, but I think it needs to be an 8-part series where you don't just focus on one individual, Dominic Cummings, as crucial as he was, and as quirky and strange and interesting a character as he is. I think it was very one-sided, and it just didn't quite flow right. At parts of the time it felt like serious drama and then satire, but it didn't show all the sides that it needed to. But Robert Mercer, who is Donald Trump's biggest donor, he appeared in it for about 90, an actor portraying him appeared in it for about 90 seconds, and sort of mentioned Cambridge Analytica. Well, he is now threatening to sue Channel 4 and presumably HBO as well for defamation over how he was portrayed in this drama, which is interesting.
Right, and what is the likelihood of that happening?
Well, I'm not sure. They will sort of be going to, I mean, if he does decide to do it, or if he's trying to get an out-of-court settlement to him, I mean, the drama's already out. People have already seen it. It's already been broadcast, so.
I was about to say, it's a bit late, and perhaps they should have thought about this beforehand. One always wonders why these, like, retrospective defamation cases are brought such a long time after transmission.
Yep.
What is it that they're trying to do? Right, let us move on to the Sunday Telegraph front page.
Yes, apart from
a picture of a dog with a flat white.
Yeah.
Which we're not going to talk about.
This is a good story on the Sunday Telegraph. It's called Ban on Gag Orders That Stop Reports to the Police. And I think this is something that countries are grappling with post Harvey Weinstein and Me Too, is these kind of NDAs that people are forced to sign. That's moves now in the UK to make them illegal when it comes to illegal conduct. So the Telegraph has very doggedly been going after Philip Green, who is the boss of the Arcadia Group, which has shops like Topshop and Topman. And he was already in very murky trouble because of how he dealt with BHS, which was a department store in the UK, which collapsed. And he was heavily implicated in that. And there was a sort of pension drain. And so he's a bit of a hate figure when it comes to business here in the UK. But then the Telegraph got wind of some of the NDAs and out-of-court settlements that he had to sign because of sexism, racism, inappropriate touching, And this is now moved by the government to put an end to the unethical use of these agreements and encourage good practice from employers and lawyers, which would be quite a big change when it comes to this kind of area of employment law.
It would be very, very strongly contested, though, by large employers who use NDAs increasingly nowadays, from everything from deciding how much they pay you and stopping you from telling your colleagues how much you're on, to the nasty goings on that we've seen happening at the Topshop empire. But how likely is this for change to actually, how likely is it the change will occur?
Well, I think we'll see. I mean, it's funny, I think this would be a bigger story but for kind of Brexit going on, because, you know, the Metropolitan Police is investigating some of the allegations that were made against Sir Philip Green, or for whether or not they're criminal. The Telegraph has a former prosecutor saying that he thinks it would meet the threshold, but they've also got a good line from Geoffrey Robertson, who is a QC, saying that the law and the change actually needs to be about the freedom of speech, the right of an employee to reveal disgusting behaviour, because it might not qualify to the limit to go to a criminal prosecution on things like racism and sexism, but that employees should be free to speak out about cultures in workplace in order to stamp them out.
And it's interesting that there's a good comment piece on this in the Sunday Telegraph on page 13, saying the government's changes, while welcome, don't go quite far enough. For a start, the committee, which is investigating NDAs, says that the misuse of NDAs to prevent victims going to the police should become a criminal offence. You say, OK, we've got the Metropolitan Police involved in this. But when you have been victimised in so many ways, you often lose your voice. Mm. And it seems that if you start putting large hurdles in the way, then actually it almost acts as a cooling effect.
Yeah.
But
it is amazing that people got away with these for so long, because essentially it's a conspiracy to, you know, pervert the course of justice by preventing information.
Yep.
You know, on a basic reading, getting to the police about criminal activity.
Okay, let's stick with the Sunday Telegraph. And Cineworld cancels free BAFTA passes in Roma Row. What's going on here?
Yeah, so this is Cineworld, which is a UK cinema chain. It has 120 sites across the UK, and it's withdrawing support for BAFTA members. So BAFTA is the British equivalent of the Oscars, and it has an academy which is made up of hundreds of people that work in the TV and film industry, and they vote on films, but they get a pass to go and see these films for free. And so BAFTA awarded Roma, which was released on Netflix, not in the cinema. It won a bunch of BAFTAs and Oscars. And because of that, and the threat that cinemas feel that streaming services having movies put out on them rather than going through the traditional, going to the cinema and then being on platforms, that threatens their entire business model. And so there's a backlash to this. And at the same time, what's interesting is that Steven Spielberg has emerged over the weekend in a fight with the movie industry, with the Oscars as well. And he wants to change the rules to stop films like Roma being able to win without having had a cinema release, because it's thought that it will simply bring down the cinema model.
Right. Is there more to this than that? It just seems like a slight case of sour grapes here, because Roma, by all accounts, is an amazing film. Mm. Haven't seen it yet, possibly because you haven't been able to see it yet. But the idea that... I just wonder whether this row would have started against a slightly more mainstream and popular and easier to grasp film.
Yeah, I mean, and this came up a couple of years ago. I think it was Beasts of No Nation. I think that was Netflix's first film with Idris Elba, where that was getting Oscar nominations. And there was the debate then as to, well, doesn't it have to go through cinemas or not? But the fact is, things are changing. And, you know, just this week, you know, a film, there's a Rebel Wilson and Liam Hemsworth film called Isn't It Romantic that was released in the US in cinemas on Valentine's Day, but the rest of the world isn't getting a cinema release. Netflix has bought the rest of the world distribution, and it then appears on Netflix this week. So this is a industry undergoing huge change, but you can understand that the cinema experience is something to be preserved. And these companies are now just worried that if this becomes the normal, then there's just going to be a collapse of these chains, which don't have big margins anyway.
Let's move on to the Observer page 9. Let's head back to politics for a minute. We were talking earlier on about how certain pinch points have caused the hardliners in the mainstream parties to soften their approach slightly to the Brexit deal. One thing that people have said has been an enormous influence has been the creation of this thing called the independent group, which is when quite a few, you know, big faces from the mainstream parties left both Labour and the Conservatives to create not a political party, but a sort of a group of like-minded people, politicians. This now appears to be on course to be a proper party.
Yeah, that's right. And this is interesting because the UK is sort of dominated politically by two main parties, Labour and Conservative, who have swapped government between themselves for much of the last 100 years, apart from, you know, a wartime coalition and the coalition that David Cameron and Nick Clegg cooked up. And so this new group is kind of, it's got eight Labour MPs, former Labour MPs, it's got three former Conservative MPs. They are all very effective communicators. They were prominent MPs, the likes of Chuka Amuna, Luciana Berger from Labour, who's done a big interview this morning in the Sunday Times as well, all about the anti-Semitism that she faced. And then on the Conservative side, people like Anna Soubry and Sarah Wollaston, also kind of quite well-known and very good communicators. And so this group announced 2 weeks ago that they were doing this. They've had drip-drip effect of MPs joining them. And I've been speaking to them this week, one of their MPs, Mike Gapes, and they had a series of meetings this week to try and figure out what it is that they are, what they want to do. And they were really boosted by some polling. So the Times the other day had put them already onto 18% support versus Labour's 23% versus the Conservatives in the low 30s and sort of, you know, really kind of demolishing the Lib Dems who had fallen. And there might be some talk of possibly a merger with the Lib Dems or some kind of pact with the Lib Dems. But what they do need to do, and I think this shows that they are really thinking there could be a snap election on the cards if the Brexit deadlock isn't broken, they have decided they'll go to the Electoral Commission and start trying to register as a party, which means they can then get members, they can then get funding, they can then start vetting candidates and putting them up around the country. And it would be an interesting dynamic because we have had not a good experience of new parties, the SDP in the 1980s, you know, getting big support, but because of the first-past-the-post system in the UK, not being able to pick up seats.
It's pretty impossible if you're not Labour or Conservative, as it stands at the moment, to make a stand. I wonder whether this will make some sort of difference. Vincent McAvinney, thank you so much for joining us in the studio. You're listening to Sunday Brunch. Finally, let's talk food. The Cut at 45 Park Lane is welcoming James Knappert in the latest of their 2019 Chef series. James is the head chef of Kitchen Table, which is a 2 Michelin star restaurant. Welcome, James. Hi. But he'll be joining David McIntyre to create a special tasting menu available for one night only, and that's tomorrow. Well, for those of us who can't squeeze in at 45 Park Lane, I'm delighted to say James has come in brandishing a bag. I want to know what's in your bag in a minute. But first, James, thank you very much indeed for coming in.
Tell us a little bit
more about your day job before we move into what you're doing tomorrow night.
So my day job's a chef. So as you said, I work at Kitchen Table, so it's full on there every day. Starting around about 8 in the morning, finishing at midnight. So we're cooking up a tasting menu for all of our guests.
And your tasting menu focuses on what? It's very British, and it's incredibly thoughtful in the way that you pull things together.
Yeah, so the British seasons is what drives the menu at Kitchen Table. I think we're very lucky to live in England, which actually has 4 distinct seasons, so like spring, summer, autumn, winter. So we always look to see what's in season from the fish to the meat to the vegetables, and this will dictate every day to how we cook.
Okay, so first practical question. It's a conversation that my cookery friends and I always have. By about February, March, your head is on the table despairing. Okay,
yeah.
The oranges are okay. Oranges and grapefruit are great, but they're not British. And everything else, you're like, I'm done. I'm done with this season.
Done with beetroot.
I'm done with turnips. I'm done with beetroot. This is the worst time of the year, isn't it? Or are you going to tell me, no, it's glorious, Emma?
We enjoy it as much. It's just you have to think different. You have to use things differently. So you have to, you know, those things that you mentioned there, like turnips. We have turnips on the menu at the moment. I think it's an incredible vegetable.
Turnips are very nice about you too.
Yeah.
So what would you do? So the idea is that at this time of year in the United Kingdom,
yeah,
particularly, if you're listening in Australia, I'm so envious of you. nowadays, the stuff that's the heavy-duty vegetables and the heavy-duty food that you've got to fight to get into.
Yes.
I mean, a turnip doesn't offer her beauties without a bit of a fight, does she?
Yeah, well, no, I think there's a lot of natural great flavour in a turnip. Right now, they're actually, like, really sweet, and we've got these big English turnips on the menu. We actually dress them in bacon fat, a little bit of sherry vinegar, and we're serving them with a roast pork dish at the moment. But also, you know, to these seasons, we can be very clever and use the preserves that we've made. So we do a lot of pickling, preserving. So this will come from thinking ahead in the summer. So we actually have green strawberries on the menu on a dish at the moment. So this was us, like, salting the green strawberries way back in, like, June. So that actually brings another element, you know, and even those being served with like a turnip dish works very well.
How thoughtful. Okay, tomorrow night,
yep.
You take all this fun and games and you take it to Park Lane.
Yeah, to do nearly as many covers as I do in a week in one night.
Okay, What are you doing? Tell us about that.
So I'm collaborating with David. So me and David have been friends now for a long time. We eat each other's restaurant and then we finally decided to cook a dinner together. You know, we're doing it at Cuck's. It can hold a few more people than a kitchen table. And this is actually a collaboration where we'll be doing dishes from each other's restaurants. So there'll be kitchen table dishes and Cut dishes. So we'll be alternating dishes. But within the same sense, they'll still marry to be a proper menu.
Take us through it quickly.
Yeah, well, we're starting we've got our famous chicken skin on. So some chicken skin, which will be spread with rosemary, mascarpone and bacon jam. So that's what's in the bag for you to try.
I've just fainted. Yeah, right. You've actually got some of
this. Yeah, bacon jam for breakfast, right?
Bring it.
Yeah.
Where is this? And right. Then, he's got the bag, ladies and gentlemen.
And then David's got like a Wagyu little tartare on that. So like Wagyu beef is, you know, very, very special type of beef. So I know he's doing that as one of the snacks. We've got a raw scallop dish. So scallops from the Orkney Islands up in Scotland. They'll be served raw with English caviar from Exmoor. So it's Exmoor caviar. So we're very proud to work with those guys.
How much fun is this for you to do? To step out of your comfort zone? To suddenly go mass catering?
Yeah. Well, it's going to be fun as well because he's got about 30 chefs and I've only got three. So it's going to be really nice just to be super organised and do everything calmly.
How do you think that's going to change? Are you going to be able to swan about just pointing at things?
Yeah, I think I might take things a little easy. No, I'm only joking. It'll be full on, but it's like, you know, we'll actually be doing covers, which is something that, you know, we never do in kitchen table in the sense of like, we might be cooking for a 2, then a 4, then a 6. Where at kitchen table, we're 10, 10, 10, 10 all the time.
Right.
So, you know, it's been a long time since I've done covers.
Okay.
Yeah.
How are you preparing for it?
Well, you know, I've done it before, and I know David's more than prepared in his own restaurant, so we'll just follow his lead, and everything seems pretty organised.
And very briefly, how much fun is it to not just jump out of your comfort zone, but to do a collaboration with someone else?
Our collaborations are great. I've done a lot of collaborations at Kitchen Table with a number of great chefs and friends of mine. And then to do it in somebody else's kitchen is the same thing, but it's just constantly every time you do it, it just makes our little network of chefs and the chef world a little smaller.
And the food is a little bit tastier too.
Yeah, James. And you see a different person's food as well, so it's always great.
James, thank you so much for joining me in the studio. Kitchen Table at Cut at 45 Park Lane is happening tomorrow. But that's all we have time for today's edition of Sunday Brunch here in London. Thanks to our producer and studio manager, George McDonough, and our researcher, Mariana Legrasta. Coming up, we have Emily King on the Midori House Sessions. And then from midday, we have the Monocle Weekly. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, it's goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.